Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The following is a presentation of the Four Center podcast feed.
From the center of the galaxy, this is the Four Center podcast feed, and this particular episode is Questions of the Force and possibly Answers. I'm Joseph Scrimshaw.
I'm Katnapsuck. We are going to sit down, look your questions straight in the eye, and give them the answers they deserve. A lot of great ones on the docket today.
Yeah, very, very excited. So we want to let you know, as always, that today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/4Center. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. We are continuing to recommend Queen's Hope by E.K. Johnston. We have loved the two previous Padme novels by E.K. Johnston, so we can't wait to dive into that one. We'll be discussing it soon. And if you want to give it a listen, you can download that free audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/4Center. One more time, audibletrial.com/4Center. Free audiobook, Padme. Yay! Any other thoughts, Ken?
No, I am about 100 pages into that book. Can't wait to discuss it, which we will next week here in 4Center.
Yep. As we record, the Thor Love and Thunder trailer just dropped with some excellent Natalie Portman content. So it's just going to be a Natalie Portman week.
And I'm excited for it. I'm going to crack that book open and try to read it probably in one sitting so I can just really immerse myself in the world of
There you go.
All right, we're going to get into these questions. We have two from Twitter, as always, and two from our patrons on Patreon. We go first to Twitter and Mark Tourish. Mark says, if George Lucas signed a trilogy deal, what differences do you think he would have made? Would the first Death Star have survived until the third film, for example? This is a really great thought starter of the idea that back in the 70s, when a chance is given to Lucas, not based on the quality of the idea of Star Wars, but on Lucas himself, as the story goes. If they said, in fact, not just one picture, a three-picture Star Wars deal, make them all, George, what would have been different? Where do you go with this, Ken?
I went to how hard is it to predict George? At times, it's really tough. You can stretch out your thoughts from centered core goals of Star Wars and all kinds of stuff. And I this question made me think a lot of the prequel era, where early magazines started to say, hey, there's rumblings of the books. Here's what we think could happen based on styles and choices George has made. Really fascinating stuff. And some of it was not accurate, but close enough from a far off perspective. So I felt like I was I'm a sci-fi magazine in 1995 right now, Joseph. So that's where I started.
Yeah, I think I start with just like, what an amazing question that is, just culturally in the movie making business and the storytelling business, right? That just how deeply unprecedented that would have been in the mid 70s. Like, it was a huge risk to make the first one. And I just think it's fascinating to remember that, like, a trilogy or a series is just sort of like, well, of course, that's the sparkle in every executive's eye that you'd get,
right?
You know, a trilogy or a series. But just thinking back to the mid 70s, when a sequel was either just a shoddy, quick attempt to make another one, or something like the James Bond series, or, you know, going all the way back to like Thin Man, of like, yeah, we follow these characters and they have another adventure. But the idea of a trilogy that's, you know, three acts, three movies, that was not in the popular consciousness, I don't think, at all, until that the 80s. So really fascinating to see what would have been different if Lucas had been in that mindset of, I have this approach I want to do. I want to tell this mythic tale that's actually also kind of instructive and inspiring for youth, but is also just a fun whiz-bang adventure full of joy. And I'm going to update all the serials I love with actual good effects. Yeah. Those are all the things that he accomplished and that he wanted to. And if on top of that, he was also, and I'm going to change the storytelling structure Hollywood by doing a trilogy. You know, I think some of the way that the original trilogy worked out is because it was a surprise, right? That there are a lot of happy accidents, right? That he was able to do it. And then with, you know, the idea that he brought Lando in, partially as a new character and partially just in case Harrison Ford was like, nah, I'm not coming back. Leave him in the ice cube. You know, a lot of happy accidents, the evolution of Vader being Luke's father, of Luke and Leia being siblings, all that stuff has kind of happened because of the way that this trilogy was made. So for me, that's all the stuff I thought of to try to get even close to imagining what would he have done if he had the knowledge that he was going to make three instead of happening on these evolutions in response to working on each film.
Yeah, you're going to a really interesting part of this discussion where, upon getting this great question from Mark, you do start, you know, having fun with just the basic plots. Would the first Death Star have just been the big evil overhanging a lot of things? Possibly. I don't think so necessarily, but then You myth starts to meld with reality, right, Joseph, where you're just like, well, yeah, so you could have moved the Vader reveal. Oh, wait, but he didn't really even necessarily have the Vader reveal to Luke. Oh, my gosh. And so you're playing this mental game with George. That's a great starting point. And it's now even more of a guessing game. But I have some thoughts on where George might have done what he might have thought of doing, I should say, in about 75. If Alan Ladd says you got three to make it happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I really want to hear the thoughts. So one thing that I do, I think that some of this question is coming from the fact that Lucas has said in interviews that he intended the Death Star to be like the big bad, the final thing that needs to be defeated. But then he put it in the first film because he didn't know if he was going to be able to make more.
Right.
And because that's always been his like, well, yeah, so that's so I put it. It was supposed to be the big ending anyway. So I put it back in Return of the Jedi. And, you know, for people who were alive when people were actually mad at George Lucas over Return of the Jedi, which I swear to you happened. That was one of the things, right? Like,
yeah.
Instead of making up a new thing, he just went like, well, I had to put it in the first film, even though it was meant to be in the third film. So then I just put it in the third film again. Oh, George Lucas. I swear, young listeners, these things happened. They were real.
But me at seven was like, oh, but it's a bigger one. Oh, that's great.
Right. Oh, and now I just love the actual portrait of evil of like, well, you blew up my big gun. So I'll make a slightly bigger one or an even bigger one, or I'll put big guns on all these ships. My only idea is a big gun.
Yeah. That's all I have. Fear.
That's what evil has, a big weapon to cause fear. Anyway, so I just wanted to clarify. I think that's where this is coming from, is that tidbit that Lucas intended the Death Star for the third film.
Yeah, sure, George. We know what you intended. Yeah, absolutely.
So where do you go? What are your storytelling ideas?
I having fun with this in this fantasy book and approach, again, if Laddie's saying this stuff, make three, make it happen. I love American Graffiti. Go for it. I wonder if George really incorporates more of what, not necessarily what goes into the prequels plot-wise, but just that spirit, that feeling of this is where the story starts. This is how things fell. And then you get more of a rebellion is born in the second episode. And in episode three, I'll follow that thread out there of the third Death Star being there, that being the final stand against evil. Maybe the Emperor's on that one. All the things we could become familiar with, you know, because of Return of the Jedi are there. I just wonder, and you know, I love the Star Wars, and I love the Dark Horse adaptation of that. That was really interesting to read a few years back. I wonder if how much of that survives, and how much do we get? Not necessarily young Anakin, not necessarily pod racing, and a bunch of Senate Chamber stuff, but a little bit more of the fall, a little bit more of him explaining this is how this happens, and I'm going to start there, and then we'll whiz bang a little bit in the second, and resolve it all in the third.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the real question is, obviously, with the story he wants to tell and with the prologue in the novelization that, you know, is credited to Lucas, but written by Alan Dean Foster, but still Lucas is directing it, that prologue sets up the political picture, right? It tells a little bit of a version of the prequel story that the politics of it was important to George, but I think he also wanted to make a whiz-bang adventure. And I think all of the people around him were like, George, that's nice that you got all your ideas, but get this movie moving so it's exciting, right? So I think that would be the push-pull, because I kind of imagine like, yeah, it would still eventually morph into being absolutely about Luke and him joining the fight. But well, what fight would he join then? Like, it wouldn't have been called the Battle of Scarif at the time, but probably the Battle of Scarif, I think. If the Death Star was the big thing at the end, probably that, like, the help that the princess desperately needs for Luke to get the call to adventure is they're making this awful weapon. We need the plans.
Yep.
So I can see that. But then I can also see, like, yeah, just more political scenes and more Palpatine backstory, because Lucas wanted to set up what is the tyranny? What does it look like? How does it work? Maybe a little bit of, you know, Palpatine still having his, there's that line from Vader, there'll be no one to stop us now, right? And I think that leans into Palpatine dissolving the Senate, which is all just exposition in A New Hope. But I wonder if we would see some of that, of Palpatine getting close to having the Death Star so he can get rid of this last shred of democracy. And you can see that moment where it turns into a total, total, full, tyranny.
Yeah, and I don't think, I think because, you know, we know what exists in the prequels, and we know the scenes we love and the dialogue that's there for us to enjoy, or, you know, at times pick apart, let's be honest. I'm not suggesting we get a safe and secure society beat at the beginning, but at the same time, maybe I am. Maybe he starts with a big fall. Maybe it is an opening 15 minutes of just the craziest sci-fi political falling of one regime and the beginning of this evil one. And from there, you know, it's kind of a, you know, truncated version of everything that happened in episodes 2 and 3. But then from there, he builds back up. And I think you're right. I don't think it moves too far away from a Luke-like character.
No.
And whether it be a young princess, like again going just to the Star Wars, the original drafts that, you know, which are, you know, deep in his yellow notepad of ideas, you know, a young princess, all that stuff, I think has to remain because that's what he was trying to do. So I think you're right about that.
Yeah. Update these classic myths. I think it would ultimately be shaped very similarly. I think you could even have Han, you could even have his moral doubt. I think and the turnaround to help at the end, it's just sort of like, what is the victory? Because I think that's also such a hugely important part of A New Hope, to make this splash and say, here's a list of all of the bad and dangerous things that really exist in the world as exemplified by this tyrannical government. But here's this hope that you can make a difference. You know, not nihilism, it's hope. So I think Luke would still have some sort of victory. So I wonder if maybe like some of the ideas that ended up being in Splinter of the Mind's Eye, the novelization that was the backup cheaper sequel, was that whole like Luke is able to face Vader because there's this kyber crystal that enhances force power. So I wonder if you get like, maybe it's the plans, maybe it's the kyber crystal, maybe that's the kind of MacGuffin of like, in order to power this horrible weapon, they need the kyber crystal. And you get an ending where, you know, Luke faces Vader in battle enhanced by the kyber crystal, like in Splinter of the Mind's Eye.
Love that. And I if I had to put some money down, I would say that Vader doesn't, it's not who Vader is now. You know, maybe it's just the evil and then maybe he truly did kill Luke's father. I wonder if that would have carried out. I obviously love Where We Go. I think it's even more powerful, but I just, at that time, I don't think George necessarily had that in mind. And that could be, you know, justice for Anakin. Killing this cyborg Vader or whatever it might be could be interesting. I don't know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the power of Vader being revealed as Luke's father is at least partially informed by the cultural response. You know, we all know the famous, you know, Lucas was a little worried about Vader. He's only actually got 12 minutes of screen time in the making of the thing. And it's when he pops into pop culture that he becomes like one of the great villains of all time, of cinema of all time. And so that I think is part of what makes the Vader parentage reveal powerful, of like, we had a couple of years of people discussing what a great kind of return to classic storytelling. You know, Alec Guinness giving interviews going, don't think about it too much. It's a simple story of good and evil. And it was that cultural reaction that Lucas was able to turn on its head of like, what if it wasn't as simple as you thought?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're right, and it's fascinating. Happy accidents, what you said up top, and I think that works, and, you know, and especially with the Leia stuff later.
Yeah, and maybe Obi-Wan survives. Who knows? My last thought.
Yeah, possibly.
Just the first film. Just the first film.
Yeah, he would have been like some lizard with four arms, but yeah, he would have survived.
Exactly. Get Obi-Wan some spider legs, some robot spider legs, right?
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on that question before we move on?
No, what it was, this was, I sat down to do the notes. I'm like, we're starting off. This is a great leadoff hitter. It's going to get a base, still second score run. It's going to make my brain hurt because it really, truly is. This is a great question that incorporates all that we know of the history of Star Wars and all that we think we know about George and what he will tell us at certain times on the journey about what he was thinking.
Yep. I greatly admire the man. He says things very, very definitively in interviews, and he says many different things too. So it is, you know, I think at the end of the day, he is an artist, and the different, you know, structure would have influenced him differently for sure, and definitely difficult to predict. All right, we're going to move on to our next question. Carl Axon Franzon asks, listening to your recent episode made me think, what are the must-watch Clone Wars episodes, maximum of 12, to get ready for the Kenobi series? Rebels Twin Sons, of course, also. So, yeah, this is I suspect that we'll have some similar ones, but maybe I'll be surprised, Ken.
Well, I think there's some ones that you kind of have to go to, and, you know, and I'm not going to lie. I typed up some articles to make sure I wasn't missing anything. And I think everyone kind of goes to some big same ones, right? As you should, right? As you should. So that's part of this. So, and I'm just, Twin Suns gets, put on the shelf. Like I said, we're talking about Clone Wars episodes. So I don't know. Do you want to just list the ones that we probably think are on each other's list? Is this a game of a card game where we're go fishing here?
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing is that, yes, there, because the Clone Wars has Obi-Wan in many, many episodes, and there are many amazing Kenobi moments if you're just a fan of Kenobi, but there are only a few arcs that are Kenobi-centric. And tell us something new about the character, or he is challenged in a way that he's not. I mean, there are many episodes where he's just great and he's just sassy Kenobi Anakin how he's messing up. But for the ones that are extremely Kenobi centric, and I think could really have bearing on the series, or at least add nuance, is that first Mandalore arc, season 2, episode 12, The Mandalore Plot, episode 13, Voyage of Temptation, and episode 14, Duchess of Mandalore.
Yeah.
And then this is the one that I'm sure we have this one as well. Mm-hmm. The Maul arc, including season 4, episode 22, Revenge, which is the first time that Kenobi and Maul encounter one another again. Mm-hmm. And then the four episodes, which are the Maul takes Mandalore. Kenobi doesn't feature in all these episodes, but I think you really got to see all four in order to understand the great importance of the story to Kenobi. So that's season 5, episode 1, Revival. Season 5, episode 14, Eminence. Then episode 15, Shades of Reason. And episode 16, The Lawless. The Lawless in particular being a huge one.
Yeah.
I also think episode 22, Revenge, is a really great and important one for Kenobi, because until our recent Clone Wars report, I had forgot how much Kenobi is prepped to give in to actual desire for vengeance from Maul killing Qui-Gon, and learns early on in this Maul conflict that is not a road I want to go down. And that's a really essential beat for Kenobi.
It really is. And because Carl put this just horrible, unfair limit of episodes on, I was trying to pick out specific ones. And yeah, Revenge and The Lawless, I think specifically, but especially Revenge. And I think you're right. It seemed like where they cross sabers again for the first time. That's so huge, and something I think I kind of forgot until we did the Clone Wars report. I think going from there. Yeah.
Yeah. And just it really shows a lot of who Kenobi is with that. Like, I have responsibility for this, and how Maul is able to manipulate him and cause basically horrific damage to other people out of his desire for revenge and to draw Kenobi out, all that stuff. Yeah, so then the place where we might differ, I don't know, is to complete my 12, I included the Kenobi undercover arc from season 4, where he transforms into a fake bounty hunter. Well, real bounty hunter, but it's fake to him. So that's season 4, episode 5, Deception, episode 16, Friends and Enemies, episode 17, The Box, episode 18, Crisis on Naboo. Did you include that arc, Ken?
I did include that arc. I think for some reason that one's, it's not that it stands out more. Let me rephrase that before I finish that sentence. The Maul and Satine stand out more than anything with the story of Kenobi, but there's just something about that as it relates to Anakin. And as we go into Kenobi, that I think is just so valuable if you're trying to get that full picture.
Yeah, I think what I totally agree. And I think what's really powerful about that arc is it's a portrait of absolutely committed Jedi Knight, Obi-Wan Kenobi, anything for the mission of, of course, I'll go through this horrific process of transforming my body physically into a bounty hunter. And then I'll go through this really arduous task of trying to get these bounty hunters to trust me and not give away that I'm a Jedi, but not let people die pointlessly all around me. It puts them under this real pressure cooker. And then the really big thing of like, no one will believe this if Anakin isn't upset, and I know that that's what you're talking about with how important it is to Anakin. But I think that is it. We know that Kenobi thinks he failed Anakin. Mm-hmm. He tells Anakin, I failed you. He says to Luke, I thought I could train him as well as Yoda. I was wrong. Kenobi thinks he made mistakes. And I think this arc might be one of those mistakes he made with Anakin.
Absolutely. And how many times is he going to be in that cave thinking about this?
Yep. Yep. So what are the differences in your 12 list?
Yeah, then? Yeah, all those there, including the specific ones there. We're really clued on that. Thank you, Clone Wars Report, for helping me clue back in on the Clone Wars and Kenobi. Here's where I went to first. I can't believe I'm even saying this in 2022. Kind of even 3-4 years ago might have been like, you're crazy. The Clone Wars movie. I really do think you get to see Kenobi fighting that Clone War, sitting there with General Lossum, all that stuff. You get to see what he was and what could be a shadow in the back of his head of not that he was a great warrior. That's not probably what he thinks of himself, but of just what he was doing, what he was involved in. It just makes me think of Leia years ago. You served my father in the Clone Wars. So actually go see the Clone Wars and see it, see what's going on there.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really great choice. Like if I was pulling moments with Loathsome.
Yeah, right.
Right. That is a big deal. It's got some great sassy Ventress interactions and yeah, mm-hmm. Kenobi being like, well, this is what we're doing. It's a war. Make the best of it.
Yeah.
Here I am being the general. I think that's a really interesting pick.
Yeah. So, and to kind of keep him with that, if you're looking at specific Clone Wars episodes, I'm not gonna lie. I was trying to pull in some, get outside the box a little bit. I put Cat and Mouse and Hidden Enemy, which are like the first two early on. Again, kind of more in line with the Clone Wars thing. Landing at Point Rain is another one of the just like, stuff going on with Anakin, stuff going with Kenobi. I put the Lost One, which we are about to dive in soon on Clone Wars Report. Mm. That is a lot of the Zyphidia stuff, and that makes me just think of Dooku and Kenobi, and Attack the Clones, and Dooku kind of saying, I'm going to make you question your trust, give you bits of truth, bits of lies, and try to evoke your master's name, all those kind of things. So just Zyphidius and a little bit more of a plot, and not that it's a true crime murder mystery, but you know what I mean, where just the big picture for Kenobi and him trying to learn more about it and learning more about it. Overall. And then my final one, I wanted to put something from the Mortis arc, but trying to keep it to Carl's limit here, which I think I've passed with vibe. I put the Altar of Mortis, which has a lot of stuff of Kenobi in a cave. and if we're going to spend some time with Kenobi in a cave and any kind of Qui-Gon force ghost talking, anything like that, that makes me think of Altar of Mortis as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty vital too, because it is Kenobi, questioning, whether he actually saw Qui-Gon, whether that's actually possible, and looking a little bit more head on at the whole Chosen One prophecy. So I think that's a great choice. I just went with the three arcs.
Mm. Well, you hit your limit.
Maybe I'm wasting spaces with a couple of the episodes in the Maul Takes Mandalore arc, but I just kind of feel like it's vital. The overall flow. But I did cheat and do some bonus ones. If you're like, okay, I did my 12, but I got time.
yes.
If you're looking for some that are just a little bit more celebration and flavor of Kenobi, I think season one, episode 15, Trespass. That's really Anakin in Obi-Wan episode, but it's the one where the Talls are being attacked by the Pantorans, and Obi-Wan and Anakin have the great cold weather gear, but a lot of great banter with Obi-Wan and Anakin, really showing Obi-Wan as a more kind philosopher and trying to bridge the gap and all that. So I love that one. Then season 2, episode 17, Bounty Hunters. There's just some really great fun and banter with Obi-Wan and Sugi, the lead hunter. Of course, some Embo. That's just a great, that's when we're also where Obi-Wan is really kind of wrestling with the philosophy of Jedi of how much can we fight a war versus train them to protect themselves, all that kind of stuff.
I love it. That's great. No, bonus counts.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any other bonuses?
the only one I put, cause we're going to review it. It's all Yoda. It's all Yoda, baby, but we might need to review or include voices, especially after we review it. We're getting to some of that stuff with Yoda and what he learns, and then sits, on the Tanaviv 3, right? Not 4. And he says, hey, I got a final mission for you, Obi-Wan. I got a final lesson. That could mean something. It's more, again, it's like, it's Yoda, but who knows? Maybe we'll get some insight and we'll see what that if has anything to do with Kenobi in the desert.
That's a really good point, because I have a hope, if not a prediction, that Obi-Wan's training to commune with Qui-Gon is either a motivating factor at the beginning, or I would love it if it was a breakthrough at the end. But they've been doing such a good job with the live action, especially with the, you know, Filoni round, of really tying, if not to direct references to the philosophy, and that that 3-episode arc really does outline the philosophy of the Force spirits.
Yeah. I mean, who knows what Kenobi's going to what he will have learned, what he will say about what he's learned from Yoda, if he'll get any information, have to discover himself. You're right. And I love that. I kind of like your idea of it being a, not a reward, but something at the end of the journey versus something at the beginning. But any Qui-Gon, even the mention of the name Qui-Gon is going to get me excited in the Kenobi series.
Yeah. I just think communing with a spirit, if that is a, if that's, and preparing yourself to become one yourself, that seems like you need to be at least some bit, a tiny bit of peace. And since we're meeting Obi-Wan agitated and depressed, it's really making sense to me that he would, you know, break through and have this victory of communing with Qui-Gon at the end, which is another way to give it a sense of hope.
Yeah, no, I think when you said that a couple episodes ago, or when we were breaking down the trailer, it makes so much sense, man. And you say a lot of things that make sense, but that makes a lot of sense to me. Of just, you're emotionally clogged, man, and you got to take some force fiber pills. Sorry, I went there, and then you could talk to Qui-Gon. You got to clear yourself, and you can't hear the force. You can't hear. Not that Kenobi's going to be disconnected from the force, but it just makes a lot of sense. And there's some about Yoda. In the arc, again, it's been a while since we've watched those episodes, and we're going to dig into them very soon here on Clone Wars Report. Mm-hmm. 3 episodes away.
Yeah.
I think there's something about Yoda confronts some stuff, and I think gets a little clear and gets some insight. So it's just fascinating.
He explicitly goes through a trial. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, oh man, I'm so looking forward to it. And I love this new way of thinking about one of the fundamental themes of Star Wars you've introduced, that a way to talk about overcoming your dark side and reclaiming a sense of hope is fiber pills. So look forward to our review of Star Wars, A New Fiber Pill, coming soon.
I request Brian Ward to make fiber pill bottles, force fiber pill bottles. There you go.
Force fiber pills. Take your pills, Obi-Wan, and you too will become one with the Force. All right, on that wonderfully weird note, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
And we are back to take more questions of the Force. These questions come from our patrons on Patreon. We're going first to Brittany Lockwood. Brittany says, which emotions do you think R2-D2 is programmed to experience and express? And which do you think are a result of his experiences in unwiped memory? I love the turn of phrase, unwiped memory. I think that is what R2's autobiography should be called, unwiped memory. A tale of an astromech. But this is a great question to think about of what's programmed and what is experiential.
What does his sort of AI programs frighteningly adapt and grow?
Yeah. So just starting out as, you know, a droid in the service of Naboo in royalty on a ship. What do you think his like initial operating parameters are? What is R2 supposed to be that he then excels beyond?
Yeah. And then, this was also a lesson in, let me look up what actually are listed emotions. Let me watch a Disney Pixar movie to learn what counts. I think I get to those. I think in the beginning though, it's emotions / mandates in a way I put things like, strength and courage, in that, in duty. So loyalty, and again, I know these aren't direct emotions. I'm just throwing a bunch of stuff on the wall here. Connection is something there too. His a sense of R2's an individual in his own way. We know that. Sassy is one thing he's probably programmed to have as well. But I think there's something about purpose, steadfast kind of nature in him, in his programming that drives him forward and I think his bravery, which often finds him all through the Clone Wars doing a lot of things we see him in the original trilogy doing, goes the way, knows where he needs to go, thinks outside the box, takes big risks. I think all that's in there, whether they're straight up emotions. I'm just saying that's part of his programming, part of who he is in the beginning.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. The two words that I came up with are loyalty and bravery. I think he's programmed to be loyal and brave. I think those are Nubian values. I think it's also what is needed practically to do the job, right? Like, we're in a dangerous situation, at least the first job we see him do, right? Cling to the ship in the middle of space under blaster fire and fix this. Don't question. Go forward and do your duty. And I think, there is no fear. There is just a classic R2 right out of the box when we meet him of I will go forward under dangerous circumstances and I will do what needs to be done. And he gets, rewarded with that compliment. I'm paraphrasing of a particularly well put together droid. If you want to go deep on this, that suggests that, look, we try to program them all to be loyal and brave, really be able to focus under pressure about just getting their job done. And some of them are better at that than others. And this one's great.
This one's the best.
This one's great at it. Well, this one's really well built, well made.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's where he starts. What of the R2 that we know do you think starts to come out of all of his lived experiences in the fact that he is he is the anti Din Djarin? If Din Djarin does not know Star Wars, R2-D2 knows the hell out of Star Wars.
He does. And this is he's got a software update that hits right when you're sitting down to play the video game and you have to wait a half hour. He's updating right now. I think I was going to put there's a sense of frustration in him at times, maybe that the big picture, and this is where it comes with 3PO and A New Hope. But that to me is a byproduct of he now has a good sense of calmness and patience because he knows he's in for the long haul. Even though he's going to be at times be rash, not out of Han Solo rashness, but just like, hey, the big picture. I think he knows this is a long play. What's going on? So there is a bit of calmness under pressure and some patience that's built into him, I think. And also I think because of that, his empathy is big and the bigger picture and trying to do what is right, I think, because he wants to help those around him and the galaxy at large.
I love that. I think the first thing I thought about of lived experience is the same as you of like I described it as a tenacity, right? Of that. If he's programmed to like, hey, when you're instructed to do something, don't have fear, roll forward or rocket forward and do it and get it done. And I think over his lived experience, he's got this tenacity and he's a self-starter. I think maybe he was programmed to be like, when we ask you to do something, do it. And I think now he's like, I take the initiative always. I see what needs to be done. And I go do it, even if nobody else sees that's what needs to be done, or maybe 3PO or even somebody else is like, should you be doing that? He's like, no, I know that's I'm going to go do that and I'm going to do whatever it takes to get it done kind of vibe. I think you're describing it as patience. I think that's great. There's that passage, I believe, I can't remember which book. I think it's a Leia book where she's talking about, like, haven't given R2 anything to do. So he's just off, like, memorizing new systems in case he needs to know them. Like, this idea that he's like your friend who's like, you tell them, like, well, for this weekend, you know, I really needed to decompress. I took a break and, like, what did you do? And they're like, I needed to decompress too. So I remodeled my entire house and I, you know, went for eight. I did 3 marathons and, you know, learned to cook a new food. Like, and, oh, that was your relaxing weekend? Like, that is R2. And then the lived experience, I think, also has just made him frustrated and grumpy and given him that potty mouth. He's been there, he's seen it, and he's got an opinion about it. What were you gonna say?
No, the frustration is big, I think that's always probably been there, but I don't necessarily think the R2 we meet coming out of Naboo is overly or easily frustrated, right? I think he's just discovering his big purpose. He's been probably pretty bored for a while. He's probably like, yes, action. I get to go out on a ship while I'm I did lose some friends, but yay, you know. But I think it starts to happen. I mean, all the things he's seen and all the characters he knows, he's the droid who knows too much, but is able to keep it secret. So I think that is true. I also put these two final ones here. And hear me out on this. There's a little bit of fear that has emerged, but I don't mean fear that's going to lead to bad things. I think I'm trying to explain it more as like a real understanding and almost you have to respect the evilness out there. He has that understanding of it, which is drives him forward even more. It's a, I don't want to say healthy fear, but you know, that thing of just like, hey, this ain't fun and games anymore. I was on Mustafar. I saw how things can get, and whether he knows Anakin's Vader, Vader's Anakin, doesn't really matter to me. He's seen the, you know, I've seen some bleep, man. I saw that safe and secure society shroud fall down. You have to take it serious. You have to have a healthy respect for it. In a way, we're going to topple it. We're going to take it down. That's why I'm here. That's why I'm running off on my missions in the desert. But I understand, and I've seen it.
Yeah. Do you think he's kicking himself? He's like, I rescued that a-hole Palpatine from the Zillow Beast, man.
Yes.
I should not have flown him out of there. I should have let that Zillow Beast eat Palpatine.
Yeah, a little bit of that. and all that leads to the final one. I think he's, I'm sure he's always had this in him, but I think he has a real appreciation for joy. You know, he's here to help restore hope to the galaxy as well. And because of that, at the end, when he's dancing with Ewoks, he's feeling joy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think strongly emotional, right? He reacts positively when he sees people he loves. He has empathy when somebody else is sad. He's got his great little moan.
Yes.
You know, I think he is, it's got that tenacious vibe. I love him being in charge of all those droids building the hut on Luke's Jedi planet that we see in the Book of Boba Fett episode. He's like the proud construction manager, you know. Yep. But I think he also kind of, he enjoys making Din Djarin wait, you know.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to teach you patience.
A lot of emotions, including, here's one I think that he develops from his experience, a slight penchant for vengeance. When he gets freed, he does not need on Endor. He does not need to zap the Ewok, but he does. He's not escaping or saving. He's just lashing out.
I don't disagree with that at all. Yeah.
And final thing for me, I think with his unwiped memory and with kind of a character trait, I think with the amount that he starts to experience and like knowledge and plans that he starts to collect, I love that it becomes a plot point in the Clone Wars where Anakin is breaking protocol by not wiping his mind. He's not supposed to know that much. It's dangerous because if he's captured, he knows too much.
Yeah.
But that scene then is a development of his character, that he has become this hoarder of knowledge, that is part of what is making him develop and what's making him stand out and be capable of things like rescuing Mace and Anakin in that arc. I think his unwiped memory is a big part of who he becomes, that he values like know everything, hoard it. I need to be 1,000 encyclopedias in one. And I do like the idea, it's been talked about a lot, I think, among fans, the idea that he is a bit fragmented, that he's got all these memories and all these systems and all these protocols, and he's seen and he's experienced so much. And I think he is incredibly empathetic to the moment. But I also like the idea that he's maybe through all of it doesn't quite understand all of human life. Like, he knows when somebody's happy, when somebody's sad, when they need something, but like, maybe just kind of can't even comprehend what Anakin is doing on Mustafar. Like, that just doesn't compute. Kind of.
Yeah.
There's something I like about that he truly sees and feels emotions in the moments, but it's kind of, maybe some of the undercurrents don't make sense to him.
I like that. Yeah. He doesn't have full understanding of what they're going through. Yeah, that kind of makes some sense. I'm there on that. And it also might allow him to, when I mentioned fear, like it's not a fear that holds him back. It's just, again, it's understanding the bigger picture where he might be like, what, why are you afraid? You just go on the ship and you try to save it.
Yeah. He's got moments of like, I think reasonable fear.
Yeah.
He loves
to hide from the Tusken Raiders. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he knows the hide from the Tusken Raiders. He knows it's a problem that at the beginning of Revenge of the Sith, when Obi-Wan's talking too loud on the comm and exposing his position. He has lots of great moments. I love it when he's like, yeah, I know that Bib Fortuna is not the kind of person you want stroking your dome.
No.
Any other thoughts on R2's development before we move on to our final question?
Well, here's my one. It's just got me thinking about R2, all his emotions and what he knows. I don't know if he feels stress or feels the weight of everything that he has inside him. Do you think at any point he has just confessed something to like some random gonk droid? Like just sitting around, he's like, hey, let me tell you something. Here, let me go back to the beginning of who's who in the zoo here. Here's what we got. I just got to tell someone.
I think so. There's something about R2 that just, he does just feel like this, like, kind of talkative lifer, who's just been everywhere and seen everything and knows some stuff and is happy to share it. Like, I think, I think some gonk droid just plug it into something and R2 would be like, you want to talk about plugging into things? Let me tell you about the time I plugged into X, Y, or Z, and then this happened, you know?
Like, if he got in that cab in the Clone Wars era with our favorite cabbie, the one that, Fives just said everything to, I think R2, it would be a dangerous combination.
Yeah, I think once you get him going.
Yeah,
Yeah. I love that. R2's a talker.
Yeah.
He's got a lot to say to Luke on Octo. Moving on to our final question. This comes to us from Commander Cloud. Commander Cloud says, greetings, Force-centered ones. As Kenobi nears its release or wraps up, depending on when this airs, we do take a while to get to all of our patron questions because we have so many good ones and we just try to take them in order. And sometimes we fall behind, but we are still before Kenobi. So Commander Cloud continues. I look forward to nearly all of my idle speculations being shot down in flames. It's nothing new as I've been way off in the past, and not just speculations like Rey is Luke's daughter or that's Plagueis' staff. As a know-it-all punk 12-year-old, I remember watching the trailer to episode 2 and thinking, well, that gave it away. All the Jedi are going to die and the Empire will rise. It's right there in the title, Attack of the Clones. No clue what they're going to do in episode 3 now. So, what were some of your most memorable speculations? Which ones make you laugh or cringe or forged you into the responsible speculators of today? Thanks, and thank you, too, for teaching me to speculate responsibly, a phrase I often recall in daily life and not just because it's on my keychain. May the force of others be with you. Thank you very much, Commander Cloud, for the stories and for the questions. Ken, where do you go with this? What are some of your speculations that you look back on?
Where do I go with this? A hall of shame is where I go. I sit there. No, first of all, it's just part of the fun. And I'm with you. I'll confess, you know, you were a 12-year-old punk kid. I was a quiet nerd in my mid-20s. And I thought the same thing about Attack of the Clones after that trailer. I was like, this is it. It's the destruction of the Jedi. Oh, my God, we're seeing it. What are they going to do? You know, I was right there with you on that. So everything else, though, is it's, you know, fortunately, Joseph, you and I have a lot of our predictions and thoughts and wants and expectations on record. several different shows across many platforms and mediums. So it can get embarrassing, but it's part of the fun. So even though I think I'm overall a little embarrassed by just my focus on it, I had a job that had to focus on it. And that just kind of leads to a lot of wild thoughts. That said, and I've mentioned that before here on the show, so I wanted to get that out there, but maybe I'll go to some specifics here. I was part of the team that thought that gravestone on Octo's got to be someone important. And I spent a lot of time wondering what it was and who it was. And even after people were like, no, I visited the island. It's just there. It's probably part of the scenery. I was like, well, they've engraved on it Wedge Antilles or something. You know, I was, it's Biggs dark letter. Like I was right there. That was of all, you know, the Plagueis staff of it all, blah, blah, blah. And yeah. The Rey's parents, what you'd tell them, that's a separate category. But man, that Luke was mourning over someone in that final shot to me for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, like recently, I liked the idea that in Book of Boba Fett, when we saw Din having the armor forge these little circles of Beskar for Grogu, I just became enchanted with the idea that that was a necklace to hang the silver ball from,
which still
was
needs.
Deeply wrong. It was obviously chainmail. That was a moment where I didn't speculate irresponsibly in that I really thought that's what it is, that's what it should be, and then I was annoyed. That's one of the example of like I took a flight of fancy of something that I thought was fun, and I focused on that rather than what was pretty clear that it's chainmail.
Yeah,
right. No. It looked like chainmail, and so I want to be clear about this. I don't mind being wrong, and I don't mind speculating. Yeah. That is the fun, but I think the danger of the speculation is becoming attached to it. You know?
Yeah, no, without a doubt. But I think look, and there's been some recent ones. I think me having this opportunity to really listen to older episodes of to fix our transition to Acast. I've heard you and I and Jennifer say some real spot on stuff. I've heard you. I mean, you had almost down to the dialogue of what Bo-Katan was going to say to Din Djarin. I want to prop you up for that. And we've also had some crazy ones in the sense of, I think, especially in the last couple of years here in Force Center, we're looking at themes. We're looking at the why. Grogu with a necklace. That's a big why. There's a lot of why that goes into that thought and that prediction and desire. So I think that's some of the big swings we take come out of tracing the themes and seeing where you can take them.
Yeah, and also just like for me, that was about the unresolved thread of the ball, you know. But we got some resolution there in a different way. And I think another one for me that I think about a lot is in the lead up to Last Jedi. Where the trailer released, there was the Jedi need to end. There was a kind of thought of like, oh, well, this is going to be the tale of a new idea emerging. And I think we're still going to be light side force users, but maybe it's going to, you know, morph into something different. I don't think that is the story. I don't think that's the intent. We talked about this a lot, but I think the story is the core ideas of the Jedi are great, and the problems happen when people stray from that path. I think that's the story train that Ahsoka has been on. I think that is the through line of Luke. It's not that all of the core ideas are bad. I think certainly the tale of the prequels of that it's not that the core ideas are bad. It's that they deviated too much from them and they didn't question enough. So I think that was kind of off in terms of the big picture of Star Wars, in my opinion. I recognize we have listeners who probably disagree with that, and that is totally understandable. But then also with Last Jedi, I think I had the it wasn't even speculation, it was desire, which is different. I wanted Luke to have been on Octo for a proactive purpose. And I think that's because I was kind of clinging to, like, I know he's probably just like real upset that everything that we know from Force Awakens, that one student turned against him, his nephew, and destroyed the school that he was trying to build. We got all that information in The Force Awakens. So why is Luke all alone on an island, bummed out? Wasn't a mystery, you know?
Yeah.
But I think I had that desire to be like, but I want him to be this hero. And then the ironic thing for me, I always think about this one, is I was kind of imagining I want him to be there for a purpose, because I want him to be a hero ultimately. And on one hand, it was wrong because it did not Rey show it up. And he's like, yes, I've been meditating on this, the secret Octo Kyber crystal and blah, blah, blah. You know, but it still ended up being exactly correct that he had proactive purpose. He wants to stop. He's afraid that he will do more damage if he intervenes. So he's got the proactive purpose to stop any more damage from happening from himself, from the Jedi. But then, of course, the whole story is he learns that it's wrong to hide. He learns that it's wrong to just listen to his fear. And the great triumph of The Last Jedi, which I have loved from the first viewing, is that he reconnects to his Jedi values and his true purpose in a way that works for him. So that's one of those, like, desires that was both wrong and then correct. I got what I wanted, but in a different way than I expected.
You're on the playing field.
I'm on the playing field. Yeah. And I think for me, it's also just, we've talked a lot about the whole speculate responsibly thing. But I think I've been thinking about it more recently about how much the Last Jedi discourse, not even any of the storytelling in The Force Awakens or The Last Jedi, but for me, the discourse in the lead up to Last Jedi really drove home what you were saying about the conflicts in the themes, in the needs of the characters, that the why is so much more important than the who or the what. The who and the what is really fun to speculate on, and I don't think we should ever not have fun. You know, we get questions about who might pop up in Mandalorian season 3, and that's really fun to guess. If a story does set up a mystery of somebody is behind something, but we don't know who, it's really fun to think of who. Yeah. I think where the problem comes in is that we're set up to wonder about stories we love. The answers are often who or what, and we're wondering about that. But I think because social media lacks nuance and because clickbait is rewarded by algorithms, I think we've put so much surface on the focus or so much focus on the surface question of who or what, that I think we've lost a little too much cultural focus on the answers only matter because what they mean for the story and the characters and any sort of ideas that the story wants to communicate about who we are as humans, what our culture is, why we exist, what we should be trying to do. Those are the things that matter. You know, I think Alex's great video that he did, Star Wars Explained, about Cad Bane, it was just such a great example of somebody who is a leader in the YouTube field, just speculating so damn responsibly of like, I do want Cad Bane to show up. I like Cad Bane. He's awesome. He's cool. But why would he show up? Here are the reasons it would matter to Boba Fett. That was such a great video. And I just, I want us to be doing more things like that. The who and the what is fun, but we can't leave the why unattached from it.
No, and when you weigh things by the why, then you either find the meaning. And it doesn't mean you always agree with it or that's what you want, but like the great cameo debate and what's nostalgia and what's to serve the story and what's, you know, that nostalgia back then. I think that's where, you know, you can, you know, just analyze it better for yourself about what you actually like when you weigh the why. And I'll, you know, look, if you catch me, you know, if you're chatting Star Wars with me on the porch of the Comedy Store and you have a great theory, I'll nod and smile and think it's great. But I think in the last year or two, I will now take a sip of my drink of choice and say, but why? Tell me why. Tell me why. And then we can have that conversation. And a lot of folks have the great answers, by the way. Think of the why, weigh the why. But yeah, I think that fuels a lot of it. And it didn't fuel a lot of my predictions in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. Me too. Any other thoughts on this great question about speculating responsibly?
Well, yeah, I just, here's some, can I share some misfires?
Oh yeah.
I was definitely on a Ezra Bridger is in episode 7, probably Max von Sydow. Definitely thought that was going to work. I don't know if the math worked out. I really was convinced Zier Leonis was going to be related to Finn in some way, which is not the best thought too, but also it made some sense. We thought it was more connected, right? This is all going to flow into something, and that was off base.
Yeah.
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
Yes. Yeah. Any other misfires? Those are good ones.
Yeah. Yes. So I was on a, there was an old movie debate show I would always be on, and they brought me in specifically to be a ringer for this question of predict what's going to happen, pitch episode 8. I had a great one. I won the round, by the way. But it was based on this idea, this, you know, some things are right. There's a vacuum of power and, you know, not right, but just, you know, with a little bit of what we got in Last Jedi, what's going on. The First Order is trying to claim the spot there, take the power. But I had this idea of kind of this three-way dance. It was, you got Luke fighting Kylo, but Kylo's fighting Benicio del Toro's character, who's very clearly going to be Snoke's other apprentice. And then Luke and maybe Kylo fight Snoke. Now, my question to myself is, where's Rey and all that? I don't remember where I put Rey in that story, but probably there somewhere, which is why it was all bad. So, it was a great, great thought, big thought, a lot of pieces on the board, a lot of what's, a lot of hows, but not a lot of whys. And so there's that one. And then the final one, I put this down, the Phantom Menace trailer. Oh, and I've said this before, even recently, as much as I love the Phantom Menace and keep loving the Phantom Menace more and more, I think it's an important film now. Always, you know, that's been growing with me, but even back when I didn't like it, I used to always say, man, that trailer is so great. I love the trailer. I want to know what that movie is. What I meant by that is, over the years, it's either been a great insult or just me wondering. That trailer, all of them, but put all the trailers together. I had the movie in a different order. I thought the pod race was a chase. I did think there was going to be a big war in Naboo, but not the one we got, not let of a blockade, but people needed to go there maybe after some people escaped. I don't know. And then I did think because of Palpatine say and wiped them out, all of them, I thought the Jedi were going to start going in Phantom Menace.
And I imagine all of those assumptions affected your first viewing of The Phantom Menace.
Yes, an early lesson in when your expectations can hamper your enjoyment.
Yeah, yeah, and that's to bring it back to this great question from Commander Cloud about Kenobi. I think that's the thing, too, is just always realizing, like, there are a lot of ways to tell a story. So if you have, like, a character that you want to appear or mm-hmm. a... like with Kenobi, like we're talking about that. What if his ability to finally connect with Qui-Gon is a sign of his success and coming to peace at the end of it? That's an idea I love. That is one way to write that story.
Yeah.
But I don't want to limit myself to, but what if the writers have a different idea? You know, putting any story together is putting together a puzzle. And sometimes a piece that's cool just doesn't fit, you know? And that's the other thing I think to really remember about speculating is, like your example of, yeah, it'd be really cool if the three-way fight between Luke, Kylo, and DJ, Benicio del Toro, Snoke's second apprentice. That's really cool. That's a piece of a puzzle just floating with no connection to anything else. So I think even when you come up with an idea of a puzzle piece that has a why and is cool, just remember that, like, that's a puzzle piece. That's not the whole story. So like if something I'm really excited about or hopeful about for Kenobi, because I have so many speculations about Kenobi, if one of those puzzle pieces doesn't fit, that's fine. I just want to enjoy the story that is being told. And if, you know, one cool thing doesn't happen, it's probably because it didn't fit in the story. You know, I just, in my opinion, there isn't right and wrong. Stories are subjective. They are flowing, organic things told by humans or a group of humans that hopefully a little bit of those human souls are in, and those souls are different than mine. And that's what makes it interesting. I just really want to approach things not as right and wrong. They should have done X and they did Y instead. Therefore, it is bad. I personally just don't want to be that way.
I want to
feel like this is flowing and organic. And I thought it would be cool if the river twisted this way around a mountain. But you know what? Mm-hmm. This human made a waterfall there, and I'm going to try to enjoy that.
No, this is a larger conversation. I've mentioned this even in joking passing through on the show before here. I'd like someone smarter, clearly, that can then put a sentence together, not like me here, to analyze our connection to, like, what we want in endings, what we want in stories, and how time and time again, endings so often break us as fans. I'm not familiar with the show, but my fiance is. But I, you know, Killing Eve just wrapped up, starring Rey's mom there, Jodie Comer. And there's so much debate and talk around. Oh, the ending was bad. The whole last season was bad. And again, I don't know the details of it, but I just would love to study where that comes from, our expectations, where we want that river to turn, and why we can't let go of it. And doesn't mean every show has been perfect. Maybe you didn't like the Seinfeld characters ending up in a prison and a jail cell. I don't know. I did. But, you know, it's just we have that connection. Think of anything big. There's been, and occasionally you'll get someone go, oh, this is, they did this one right. And even that can be debated. But you know what I mean? I don't have an answer. I just want someone to study why that happens time and time again.
I think that is such a great, a big question to have about the way we process stories. So we should dive into it deeper. But I always think about Lost. I haven't seen it for years. I am not a Lost expert. But I remember being really satisfied by the ending of Lost because I felt like the characters all did the thing that they deeply would do and needed to do and wanted to do. And then, like, yeah, the answers to the mysteries were like, yeah, whatever.
That was
one of the, like, I remember that Lost ended around the same time that Battlestar Galactica did. And like, I thought in Lost, like, some of the answers in the mysteries were like, yeah, sure, whatever. But the characters fulfilled their journey. So I liked the Lost ending. And then the Battlestar Galactica ending was like a lot of cool conceptual things happened, but I just kind of felt like, I don't know that the character, why did the character that would normally argue about that decision for a season and a half just agree to that? So I think maybe a part of it from that example is just who we are as individuals. Like, I care more about the character stuff in this story meaning than the answers.
Yeah,
and I think that's a fascinating part of that, how we process endings. What do we want?
Yeah, the Battlestar one, you'd need a documentary on that, what happened and how that, it's fascinating. I agree with you. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know. Again, I don't know the answers. That just, it factors always into Star Wars conversations.
It really, really does. Yeah, a lot of big ones, including, you know, a lot of the tension about the sequel trilogy of should it have just been a happy ending? Right. The Ewoks dance and leave it alone.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. A great discussion for another time, as Maz Kanata would say. That is our episode, Questions of the Force. Ken, do you want to let people know where they can find us?
I'd love to. We're the Force Center Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Force Center Pod. We're on Instagram, YouTube as well. We'll have another live Q&A show soon. We'll let you know when. Facebook page is Force Center Podcast. Podcast available on Acast, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and more. Just search. You'll find us. Merch available at tpublic.com/user/Force Center. Go there and get your Speculate Responsibly t-shirt and wear it before you see the first episode of Kenobi at Star Wars Celebration. Patreon.com/Force Center is where you can support us directly. You can follow me at Ken Napsok or go to my website, kennapsok.com. From there, you can link to tickets for a big, cool upcoming show if you're SoCal based, June 4th at the Troubadour, Doug Weston's Troubadour in West Hollywood. Be performing on a big comedy show there with Mark Ellis hosting and Ryan Sickler headlining there. That is for me. What about for you, sir?
Yeah, you can find me Twitter, Instagram, TikTok is at Joseph Scrimshaw, and you can check out all of my other comedy adventures, past, present, and future, on my website, josephscrimshaw.com. But for now, for myself, for Ken, for R2-D2's potty mouth, this has been Questions of the Force.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.